caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering. Waking to a dream within a dream. I think I remembered those correctly. I'd like to say something about those verses as a way of building a bridge to our discussion later this morning about empathy and self-psychology. But we'll start with this idea of a self-centered dream. A dream is something insubstantial, a fantasy. And this says that we're all caught up in the midst of a particular kind of dream, a self-centered dream. What does that mean? See, to put the self at the center of things is part of a way of being in the world that's organized around, let's say, control and autonomy. To be self-centered is to try to set up a particular kind of boundary between self and the world. And we may try to be in control of everything inside within that boundary and make ourselves invulnerable to the changes that go on outside that boundary. That means both not being affected by those things and not needing anything that comes from the outside. And the wish to do that is a dream, is a particular kind of fantasy. It's trying to imagine something that we think is ideal, but is impossible. And it's impossible not just because we can't quite manage to do it. It's not a technical or pragmatic failure to make it happen. It's more that it's a logical impossibility. It goes against the very nature of what a self is and what the self's place in the world is. The self, by its nature, can never be separate or autonomous the way it is in that fantasy. It's not what selves are. So in that first verse, we get the assertion that to believe in something that's not only impractical, but logically impossible, is to keep us in a constant state of suffering. We're always going to be beating our head against reality. But what's the alternative to that? Waking to a dream within a dream. It's saying that in some sense we wake up from one dream only to find ourselves in the midst of another dream. We want to create a kind of sharp division between waking and dreaming, but that itself is problematic. Now, one way to describe that is to say that our original self-centered dream is a dream of permanence and autonomy, separation. That's an illusion. The world just isn't like that. So we wake up from that dream. But into what? See, a dream by its nature is ephemeral, impermanent. It displays, in a strange sense, all the properties of what we call the real world, right? It has no unchanging solid ground under it. It has no unchanging permanent essence. Just all these fleeting images, one thing after another. And the verse tells us that what we wake up to is a realization that reality is like that. That it's not just a quality of dreams, but a quality of life as it is, to be insubstantial, impermanent, ever changing, no fixed boundaries. Now, some of you may be familiar with contemporary versions of Stoicism, which seem to be popular now. And Stoicism was a classical philosophy. The Greeks and the Romans associated with Zeno, Seneca, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius. And it had core ideas, some things that are very valuable lessons. They attempted to say that we should concern ourselves only with what is under our control, and not essentially make ourselves crazy trying to control the uncontrollable. And in their way of looking at things, the outside world was a world that's out of our control. But the inner world, the world of our own ascent, our own way of being and seeing things, that was an inner world of potential self-control and mastery. And so they would, I think, come up with a very useful ethical formulation, such as what's important is not what happens to you, but how you respond to it. Your responsibility is to behave well when you're treated badly. But that's sort of the essence of an ethical life. And that way of thinking is an extension of Socrates' maxim that a good man cannot be harmed. He tried to model behaving well, being a teacher, no matter what was happening to him or around him, even when he was unfairly tried and put to death by his fellow citizens. Even in the midst of that injustice, he could behave well and maintain that kind of control. So they're very valuable lessons to be practiced from that perspective. But from a contemporary and particularly a psychoanalytic point of view, we no longer think that the inner world is a world over which we have more control than we have the outer world. We could say that the whole notion of the unconscious means that there are realms of the mind, the realms of who and what we are, that are out of our awareness, out of our control, and that in a sense, we have to be able to simply watch them arise in the same way we watch things arising from the outside. That we no longer can maintain this fantasy of internal autonomy. See, that to me is also an awareness of interdependence and the notion that the self is not something that resides deep inside and is private to each of us, and that which we have unique access to this inner world. But rather the self exists at the boundary between us and our world. It's all our actions and relations, the world in which we're embedded, the relationships that define us. So who am I is not a private inner experience. Who I am is a teacher, a father, a partner, a New Yorker. I'm all these relational constructs. And part of waking from our dream is to acknowledge that who I am is inseparable from all these relations and everything that's going on around me. One of the innovations you see in the paper we're discussing is Kohut's invention of this strange word, self-object. It looks like two separate words glued together. Originally, he put a hyphen in between them, but eventually he dropped the hyphen. And sort of typographically asserted the inseparability of self and other. Object in psychoanalytic lingo is an unfortunate word they use for other people, objects. Originally, I think it had to do with the idea that other people were the objects of our libidinal desires and attachments. But we can just think of it as other. So self and other are not separate. They're glued together from the beginning. And in a way, it's a psychoanalytic version of the Hegelian idea, I can't be myself by myself. The other important issue that's raised in these verses has to do with the appearance and reality distinction. The ordinary way of thinking about things, we sometimes imagine that we have our own particular perspective on things, our way of seeing them, and that we represent the world to ourselves by creating an inner picture of it. We gather all this sense data about the world, how it looks and feels and sounds and tastes, and we gather all this information that our senses give us, and that our brain inside then assembles that and creates a picture, a representation, an appearance. And then we want to know, how well does that picture actually correspond to the reality out there? And we immediately run into a difficulty of how do we test one of our representations? See, if we know the world only through building up internal pictures, how can we compare the picture to the world? Because we only know the world through a picture. If we get more and more data, what we're doing is creating a different and we hope better picture. But there's no way in which we can ever take the picture and hold it up next to the world and see how well it matches, because the world just is available to us through a picture. We never are able to access, as Kant used to say, the thing in itself. And part of what Hegel suggested about that dilemma was that reality is a kind of logical construct that we need to make sense of the notion of perspective. Once we start realizing we have a different perspective on things, once we realize that I see things a little differently than you see things, or that when I see a stick in the water and it looks bent, when I take the stick out, it's straight. So I realize the looking through the water has done something to my perspective. And so we, in engaging the world, we're always engaging it from one perspective or another, trying to improve that perspective. But the whole notion of perspective, in a certain sense, is parasitic on or logically dependent on the idea of perspective on something, right? So we create the notion of reality as is, it is in itself, in order to have the idea of perspective on something. Now, what happened, the way this gets relevant, I think, in Buddhist practice and how it's linked up to the empathy paper, is it's built in to our language and our way of thinking about things that somehow we should be able to have a perspective-free view of reality just as it is. That we think of, say, our self-centeredness or our ego as a set of rose-colored spectacles through which we see the world, right? And there's the promise at some level that we can take them off, that through some kind of practice or experience, we'll get rid of this egocentric or self-centered distortion about what reality is and finally get to see things just as they are, right? Now, seeing things just as they are is a certain kind of fantasy of objectivity. And it plays out in religion as a fantasy about the nature of the enlightened master, having thrown off the ego, she's able to see things clearly, directly, without distortion. In the Western model, this is an objectivity that's attributed to the scientist. The scientist is going to look at things objectively, just the facts, no subjective perspective imposed on the facts, nothing, no personalized story imposed between me and reality. Part of what Kohut was doing was dethroning the analyst from the position of scientist who presumes to say how things really are. See, in a classical model, the patient's transference or just their neurotic personality is presumed to distort reality, right? In the sense of, I'm going to see everybody just like my authoritarian father, and I'm always going to be in guard against that kind of abuse of power, and I'm always going to be in a conflicted relationship of envy and resentment and competition, right? And I'm going to bring that to all sorts of relationships. Regardless of who the other person actually is, I've got this built-in perspective through which I see you. And perhaps there's going to be a way through the course of the treatment that I'll be able to drop that. But the analyst from the beginning looks at the situation and can see, because he's seeing objectively, that this is a distortion, right? Something that you're bringing with you and imposing on the situation that's basically not true. So that the analyst is, in that sense, in the mode of the scientist. He's going to be the arbiter of what's a distortion and what's real. And by and large, the course of the treatment is going to be to get you to drop your distortions and see things as they really are. Now, that description transposed into a religious context is not so different from what some people expect the teacher to be doing. And you're coming in with all your egocentric, self-centered distortions, but the teacher is free of all that and clear-eyed. And so they too occupy this quasi-mythical position of seeing things objectively, seeing things just as they are. The other way this plays out in meditation practice is through the fantasy of pure awareness. This is the kind of practice that aims to purge consciousness of its contents so that you no longer have contaminants of thoughts or feelings or perspectives, but you get down to just awareness. There's no awareness of anything. There's just awareness. Clear blue sky, nothing in it, right? And sometimes that pure awareness is described as the mirror. Everything that comes in front of the mirror is perfectly reflected without distortion because the mirror has now been wiped free of dust. And some of what the way the teacher's role is described is to be this perfect clear mirror in which the student sees themselves reflected back. Now, what I would like to suggest is that the fantasy of pure awareness, of the perfectly clear mirror, of the teacher who is free of ego, and therefore sees reality directly just as it is, without any imposition of some false representation. All those things are sort of culturally the mirror image of scientific objectivity and the view from nowhere, the view that we can have a kind of God's eye view on reality just as it is without our personal perspectives ever getting in the way. So part of what we're going to see in the empathy paper is the gradual abandonment of that particular kind of fantasy and the recognition that when we start trying to understand things from a patient's point of view, we use empathy as vicarious introspection. We can never do that in a perfectly clear way in which our own perceptions, our own personality, our own point of view is somehow completely swept away and kept out of the picture. There's not ever going to be this view from nowhere. It's always going to be a view by somebody situated somewhere. All right, I see I'm out of time here, so I will stop now and we can continue in the discussion. Thank you.